The following audio is from Faith Bible Church in Spokane, Washington. Visit fbchurch.org/sermons for more.
All right. You have to talk about this topic of psychotropic drugs and biblical counseling. We've touched on it a little bit when we were talking about depression. Didn't really touch on it in the anxiety one, although most people who are diagnosed with any kind of general anxiety disorder are probably taking medications. Probably 1 in 10 Americans now are on some kind of psychotropic medication for some mental illness. I don't think they call it mental illness anymore. They call it mental health issue, right? I think is how they say it. That's the politically correct way of saying it now. And again, with the issue of medications and how they help us with our problems, there is a social consciousness, kind of like with addictions. There's a social consciousness with why medications are prescribed to help with problems like anxiety and depression and other things. And by that, we mean there's a prevailing view in our culture or our society that is accepted as generally true and undeniably true. And when you question those assumptions or beliefs, you're kind of looked at really kind of square. So there's a lot of reasons why those kinds of shifts take place in our culture, why they're accepted widely as they are. But a lot of these so-called truths that are inherent in our social consciousness aren't necessarily true. They're just believed to be true. Just like at one point it was part of the social consciousness that the world was flat, right? That was true. At one point in history, the world is flat, slavery is justified, and burning at the stake is a valid punishment for teaching heresy. All of those things were just accepted as true and practiced, and or the implications of them were practiced. So that's certainly not the thing. It's part of the social consciousness today to believe that homosexuality is something people were born with, right? That's going to be kind of the phrase people use. I was born that way. So, you know, the video that was going around for a while on Facebook is the guy that goes out on the street and they're interviewing people. Do you think people are born homosexual or do they choose to be a homosexual? And they would go, oh, I think they choose that. I think they choose that. And then they go, and when did you choose to be a heterosexual? Yeah. And they put the microphone back in their face, right? And it's kind of this really powerful and effective polemic to show how stupid it is to think that someone is not actually born homosexual, right? And of course, there's a logical fallacy in there because I don't have to choose to be what is natural. I have to choose what is unnatural, right? So if someone were to put that microphone in my face, that'd be the next point I would make with them. But most people on the street, they don't think logically anymore because they don't learn Latin and read the classics. It's all about classical education. And that's what I'm really here to talk to you about today. No. Yeah, it's logic. They don't even teach logic in school anymore, which is just a shame. So when people are making these dumb arguments on Facebook and social media, people are too dumb to listen to logical arguments. It's just really crazy to me that people don't learn logic anymore. So anyway, don't get me on that soapbox. Whoops. By the way, people ask me that question, which I get asked a lot about homosexuality. I ask them, have you ever seen studies where they have examined the homosexual tendencies, behaviors, choices of identical twins? No, I have not. Well, they're out there, and there's countless examples of identical twins where one is homosexual and one is not. If homosexuality were genetic, if homosexuality was determined by your birth and your genes, that would be impossible. Right? I mean, it's a slam dunk case. You're never going to see that on the secular media, but it's a slam dunk case. But the social consciousness is, if you say stuff like that out loud, right, you're all kinds of things. I mean, I might have just committed a hate crime. I'm not sure, but in certain countries, I probably just did. So we may have just bought ourselves 4 more years of being able to talk like that. I'm not even sure that's true. So when we discuss certain problems that people have, symptoms, disorders, conditions, and when we discuss whether they're caused by physical, environmental, or spiritual factors, we're confronted with this really strong cultural bias that many conditions find their source in chemical imbalances in the brain. That is a really common thing for people to talk about, say, that depression, anxiety, ADHD, bipolar, borderline personality, all kinds of things caused by chemical imbalances in the brain. Everybody's heard that phrase, right? Everybody's heard that phrase. That's why we have to talk about this topic. Listen to what was said over a decade ago about the cause of depression by no less reputable an organization as the Mayo Clinic. Is this in your notes, this quote? There's no single cause for depression. The illness often runs in families. Notice the word illness. What does that imply? It's a medical condition, right? That word implies medical condition. The illness often runs in families. Experts believe a genetic vulnerability combined with environmental factors such as stress or physical illness may trigger an imbalance in brain chemicals, resulting in depression. Imbalances in 3 neurotransmitters, serotonin, norepinephrine, and dopamine, seem to be linked to depression. Scientists don't fully understand how imbalances in neurotransmitters cause signs and symptoms of depression. It's not certain whether changes in neurotransmitters are a cause or a result of depression. So I can tell you, when I say stuff like that to people, they look at me like I'm crazy. And when I tell them, no, that's the Mayo Clinic talking, they're like, no, they don't believe me. That's how powerful the social consciousness on this issue is. When you tell them, no, the Mayo Clinic says that. Over a decade ago, they were already saying that. They don't think I'm telling them the truth. So the suggestion or theory, it's really a theory, that imbalances in brain chemicals cause symptoms of various disorders is not settled science. So many people believe that. A lot of people promote that. It's hard to argue against. But even the Mayo Clinic is suggesting there's various factors that may trigger a chemical imbalance. They also question whether that's a cause or a result. Right? So as soon as you start asking these questions, I'm sad to say that many people are going to quickly dismiss you. They're going to say, you don't know what you're talking about. You don't have any expertise in this. Who are you? You're not a doctor. You're not a scientist. You're not a neurologist. How do you know? If they don't dismiss you because of your lack of understanding and expertise, they will probably question your compassion or your concern for them. Right? So it's hard. It's really hard to talk about. And it's hard to talk about because this is really something the culture has embraced, not because of scientific evidence, but because of, it's because of advertising as much as anything, to be honest. So here's another source who expresses the same uncertainty, but does it even more bluntly and more recently. Dr. Joseph Coyle, professor of neuroscience at Harvard Medical School. That's pretty reputable, I would say. In an interview in 2012, he said, chemical imbalance is sort of last century thinking. It's much more complicated than that. It's really an outmoded way of thinking. So he's really suggesting that depression and a lot of other maladies are caused by a chemical imbalance is really not what the current researchers are thinking. That's not even the direction they're going in trying to find cures and help. The only people that are still going in that direction are the pharmaceutical companies who have billions of dollars wrapped up in it already, both in their research and development of new drugs and in their advertising for them. So now the drugs work in a sense. If you consider the definition of working as changing or improving people's feelings, generally they work. But they do only work in that sense for about 70% of patients. So only about 70% of people who get on these drugs to help correct their chemical imbalances actually experience the change or the better feelings that they were hoping for. But change in feelings shouldn't be the only measure of success, or shouldn't be the only way to define whether or not a drug works, because as we just talked about in our last session, a lot of people run to alcohol and marijuana and all kinds of other things in order to feel better, right? And if feeling better is the goal, then that works too for some people. In fact, it probably works for 100% of people who smoke marijuana. I don't think I've ever talked to someone who smokes marijuana who doesn't say, I feel better when I smoke it. So then it works. It's even better than those. And I'm not advertising for it, but I'm just saying. No one's going to suggest those are viable treatments, but that's that's changing too, right?
That's not true.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. We can just, the billboards are telling us it's good for us. So, but all of that to say, yes, the drugs change the feelings and they do something. Whether it's doing something good or bad is, I think, remains to be seen. How about a little bit of history? I don't remember how much of this is in your notes. Let me tell you how our world started using these drugs. In the 50s, and we talked about a history of counseling and secular counseling. In the 1950s, most mental disorders, the stuff that depression and anxiety, borderline personality, bipolar, which was then called manic depression. In the 50s, most of those conditions were considered to be the result of social circumstances. And so almost all the therapy that was done was talk therapy. So it was like we used the word counseling. There were people talking to each other and different kinds, right? There was psychotherapy and the Freudian stuff and the reflective therapy, the Carl Rogers stuff. We talked about the differences of those. But most of what was done was talk therapy. And at the end of the 50s, in that decade, a new drug was developed, Thorazine. And it was developed and became a treatment of choice for people diagnosed with schizophrenia. Schizophrenia, we haven't really talked about that. It's a somewhat bizarre behavior. And at the time, they were treating people that were being diagnosed with that bizarre behavior. They were treating them with morphine and opium. And for people who wouldn't cooperate, they would just pump them up with so much insulin that they would kind of go into a shock so that they were unconscious. So that was how they were treating schizophrenics. So they developed this drug, Thorazine, to treat schizophrenics. And in the 60s, they discovered that these neurotransmitters that we've talked about, dopamine and serotonin, served as the chemical signals that allowed the brain to communicate. That's how the brain works. You have these little cells in your brain, and then in between the cells are these synaptic junctions. And the way the brain sends signals is that these little chemicals just jump from one to the other. That's how it works. And so serotonin, dopamine, norepinephrine, we saw that one. That's how the brain works, is it sends these signals electronically back and forth. And Thorazine had the effect of inhibiting the dopamine receptors in the brains of mice, and potentially was explaining why it had that sedating effect in humans. So they started to develop more drugs based on that observation. If we can shut down these receptors in the brain, then we can sedate people, we can change the way people behave. And so they just started researching that stuff. Around the same time, they observed that patients that were being treated with some other drugs that weren't designed for that purpose, a few of them, I have them listed here, I can't pronounce them really, but they were using other drugs for non-psychiatric illnesses, that they started to experience improved moods. And that's when they started to hypothesize that these serotonin-inhibiting drugs improved people's mood, because depression must be caused by increased serotonin levels. So if they can inhibit the serotonin passage back and forth, if they can slow that down, then people who are depressed will have improved moods. Now, the problem with the theory was that of the three drugs that they mentioned in this short history, two of them inhibited the serotonin, one of them increased it. So, and all three of them helped some people improve their mood. So it's kind of a statistical thing there, right? So if it helps some, it must be good. Let's try it. And so it just really became a research thing, trial and error. And that's what they began to do. So all of these factors happening in the late 50s and 60s really contributed to the growth of what I've called here biological psychiatry, which emphasizes this potential biological basis for mental disorders, right? That's really what we've gotten to. And again, as we were talking about last hour, there's a naturalistic, materialistic, evolutionary view of the human condition, the human experience, the human being that makes that make sense, right? So that's what's going on. That relationship, that trend that there's biological causes for psychiatric problems, which caused psychiatrists and pharmaceutical companies to begin working together, that trend has only continued and strengthened since the late 60s and to the present day. It was actually in the 70s that they discovered or invented or Prozac and Zoloft, which for years were kind of the benchmarks, the most popular, most well-known brand names for this class of antidepressants called serotonin reuptake inhibitors. So they inhibit that passage of serotonin from brain cell to brain cell. SSRIs, they're called. I think that might be in your notes. I'm not sure. So the thing is that if you were to grab a box of Prozac and pull out, you know, every little box of pills has a little insert, the little drug insert. And every single one, and I've read dozens of them for all different kinds of drugs, they say something very similar. And what they say, you don't have to read the drug inserts, by the way. Pick up Good Housekeeping, right? There's all the drug advertisements in just about any magazine nowadays. So you can pick one up. And that print is so small. So get a magnifying glass, and it's in there. It's in those little advertisements. You can read it, and they'll all say something very similar, and it will repeatedly highlight one important fact: we don't know how it works. That's the important fact it will say over and over and over again. You won't be able to find an advertisement or an insert in a drug package that doesn't say something like, it is believed, something like that. And so it's kind of similar to that statement from the Mayo Clinic, those drug inserts. It is believed that this will impact your brain chemicals. This may trigger improvement in your symptoms. Imbalances seem to be linked to depression. It will use words like that. It is believed, it may, it seems. Over and over and over again, these drug inserts will say words like that. In other words, we don't know and it's not certain. Now, why would they say that in the small print? Yeah. And if they say they do know and that it is certain, they get sued. Right. And in fact, I'm not even going into this, but they have all been sued at some point, and they've done a really good job of keeping those things out of court. So, were you going to say something?
It's just a giant bot. They're basically not even saying anything with that statement. Because it's all assumptions and hypothesis, maybe this we think, you know, it's like anyone could write a statement like that.
Right. So technically
they wouldn't be wrong though, because they're not saying this is absolute, this actually does
that. And that's what they're guarding against, is making any absolute statements. So And they can't make absolute statements because it's not proven. It's not proven that imbalances are the real cause of these problems, nor is it proven that taking this pill corrects something that's wrong. What they do know and can observe is that most people who take them feel better. So let's just keep doing it. That's what we do know for the most part. So it's actually not even possible, because of the microscopic nature of how these chemicals pass from brain synapses, you can't actually measure serotonin levels. Because in order to measure serotonin levels, you'd actually have to take out the brain cells that pass them. Anybody volunteering? Yeah, you can't do it. So the closest that they can do is to measure similar effects in cerebrospinal fluid, which isn't the same thing. And when they have done things like that to try to study chemical relationships to depression and its effects, it's all been inconclusive or conflicting. So the science is just out. It's undetermined. It's uncertain. And that's the only thing that's definite. So back to the quotes from the Mayo Clinic and the neuroscientist at Harvard Medical School, right? All of it is theory. That it's uncertain, yet it continues to be perpetuated in the populist opinion. But in the neuroscientific world, it is increasingly becoming passé. They're not even thinking that way. That's what the dudes at Harvard are like. That's like so 20th century. This is 2016. We're not talking about chemical imbalance causing depression anymore. So it's kind of scary, actually, that that's what we've gotten to. So you're going to find, if you do real research on the effectiveness and the reliability of these drugs, you're going to find a lot of confusing and sometimes conflicting information about their effectiveness. And people continue, even in the literature, to use the phrase the theory of chemical imbalance, and that only helps us see that the cause of all these disorders are uncertain at best.
Why don't medical doctors who are medically trained and they live on research, why don't they read the research and throw this stuff out? Why do they do that? Because the doctors keep shoving this stuff on
you. Yeah, so I was hoping Brian Yates was going to be here, because he's a doctor and maybe he could tell us. My gut response to that is twofold. One, remember, let's go back. The drugs work. They make people feel better. Yeah. So again, you know what? If I'm a doctor and people feel bad and they come to me and say, I want to feel better, and I have a pill that might make them feel better, I'm going to try it out. And I'm going to do that probably if I'm a Christian doctor or not.
And the patients are also seeing the ads on TV and going, I want this stuff.
Unfortunately, yes. They see the ads on TV or in magazines, and they think this might help me. And, you know, sometimes they're asking the doctor for a particular pill, or the doctors have access to another one. The only good thing that's happened probably in the last 20 years is I don't think doctors can get kickbacks from pharmaceutical companies anymore. That used to be the case. 25 years ago, I think doctors were getting pretty good kickbacks from some of these companies, and I think they've outlawed all that now. I had a conversation with one of the doctors here at church about that, and I'm pretty sure that doesn't happen anymore. So, and he was like, oh yeah, I mean, years ago we used to win these cruises and stuff. And I don't think they're doing anything immoral there, I'm sure. But still, I don't know about the pharmaceutical companies. I think they've got their own motives, right? So, yeah, why don't they do it? I don't know that they have to stop using them, and I'm not going to tell doctors that they shouldn't use them. If people are feeling better, that might be okay. I think there's conflicting research out there about the long-term side effects of some of them, too. So some of the effects, the long-term effects that can result from... Well, just think about it. Do you think there could be long-term effects to inhibiting the normal transfer of brain chemicals?
Well, there are certainly short-term effects. Anybody who is on these kind of medications... You talk to them, they'll tell you all of the short-term effects.
So there are potential long-term effects, and some people have suffered some grave long-term effects from those. So I have a book on my shelf called Prozac Backlash. It's not a Christian book. It was written by a secular doctor about the long-term effects that he was seeing in patients that were taking Prozac, and some of them are pretty frightening. There are a number of people for years that developed permanent tics, so that would look like Tourette's type symptoms. So permanent tics, vocal and physical tics. That the first story that he tells in the book is about a lady who developed these uncontrollable tongue thrusts. Like, she looked like a lizard. She just walks down the street and her tongue is like, you know, and human-sized tongue. I mean, she didn't like develop a long tongue with forked tongue or anything like that. But just imagine, and that's why he started researching it. As he looked at her case and her file, he was like, I can't see anything else that might have caused this other than the drug. So, yeah. So that's when he started doing some of this research and he wrote that book. But imagine having to live in your life the rest of your life that way. I mean, I wouldn't go out. Would you go out in public? Oof. So, again, are those rare? They're absolutely rare, right? So I'm not... Please don't go out and say, oh, Brian said if you take those pills, you'll start thrusting like a lizard. No. I don't think that's really going to happen, but... Oh, man. Okay. So let's look at this broad topic here. Are psychological drugs needed in biblical counseling? Well, let's think for a second how they work. So there's a lot of different medications, but the most common ones are these SSRIs. And here's a picture of how it works, if you can see it. So these are those brain cells that I talked about, and they pass these chemicals back and forth. And so within the brain cell, you see in the lower circle there, there's, I don't know what they are, but they kind of suck the chemical in from one cell to the next. Just shoots it across, suck it in, shoots it out, sucks it in. And that's how the electrical signals in our brain are sent, are through these chemicals. The term chemical imbalance is the term that people use for the theory that one of those chemicals is too high or too low, and improvement of feelings as a result of the chemical doesn't prove there was a chemical imbalance. In other words, you take an SSRI and you feel better, doesn't necessarily mean your chemicals were out of whack. It just means you've changed your chemicals. It's only a theory, it's not a fact. We've established that. It's not even necessarily a popular theory in neuroscience field now. And even if a correlation could be found, it's kind of like we were talking about in the last session with addiction. The cause and effect is not certain. And that's another issue, right? It's not a cause and effect. So maybe the sinful behavior comes first. Maybe the depressive symptoms or the anxiety symptoms come first, that you experience this oppressive glut of wrong thoughts and wrong feelings, and it produces this messed up condition in your brain, if it really is messed up, right? If it really is imbalanced, so to speak, and then the medication is needed to restore it. So it isn't necessarily that the imbalance caused the depression. Maybe the depression caused the imbalance. Maybe that's why the pill works. So again, you just can't determine the cause and effect pieces of it. And that's what makes it so difficult. By the way, I have some research in my office on PMS. I'm sure it'll be really popular with all the ladies. And they can prove with PMS that, you know, women who are going through their cycle, they have hormonal changes, right? And there's certain times in their cycle when the hormones are high and certain times when they're low. That's how it works. That's how the body's designed to work. And what they find is that, and this is certain, that some ladies have those symptoms of PMS, the pain or the grumpiness or the whatever, the fatigue, when the hormones are high. And some of them experience the same symptoms when the hormones are low. So what's really going on, this is my interpretation, what's really going on is, man, it's hard when our body's changing. That's what's really going on. It's the changes, not so much as the high levels are causing these symptoms. It's just that, man, when things are changing, you get kind of different, right? Emotionally, it's hard to handle, right? That's fine. Now, is it causing it? Are there high or low hormones causing it? It's contributing to it for sure. Men, be patient and kind and gracious, right? It's just contributing. It's not causing. I don't think it's that different here. Got different brain chemicals going on. Is it causing it? It could be contributing to it. It probably is, but we don't really know how.
Elizabeth Elliot wrote an article on that, and she would say it's bad behavior.
Yeah. Well,
it was interesting.
The women have us outnumbered, so I'm not going to say that here, but
And now sin that we have no control over.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Careful. Okay, so there is often a subtle, sometimes not so subtle, but often a subtle difference between medicine, like doctors, and psychiatry about what is a real disease. So this is, it's kind of going back to our discussion about even addictions as a disease. Now we're talking about chemical imbalance, and is that a disease, right? So, but generally, this is true in the field of medicine, there are organic causes of some behavior problems. We've talked about that during the depression one, right? Thyroid problems, Parkinson's, different real medical conditions can cause the symptoms of depression. But again, in that case, what is diagnosed is the hypothyroidism or the Parkinson's, or what's diagnosed is the medical condition with the measurable pathology. They don't diagnose depression. The depression symptoms are just a symptom of the medical condition. So that's what happens. The diagnosis describes disease in the body of some kind, some dysfunction of your body, not the symptoms of the feelings that are produced by it. And so that's what happens in the medical field. Typically, is to qualify as an illness, there has to be some kind of damage or dysfunction in the way the body is working. So in psychiatry, that's not true, right? That diagnoses are made, like we talked about in the depression thing, on self-reported feelings or behavior. Nothing is measured because nothing really can be measured. You can't measure their anxiety chemicals. You can't measure their depression chemicals. There's no physical pathology. So in the field of psychiatry, this theory results in reporting of symptoms, and that's how the diagnosis is made, which is different in the medical field when real diseases are causing the same symptoms. So now I don't think there's always a rigid divide between the two. I think most doctors, and this kind of goes back to Joanne's question, I think most doctors and psychiatrists want to keep up with the current research. I think doctors and psychiatrists are required to do certain amounts of that. Like, I don't know, once a decade, I think doctors have to retake their medical board exams. Does anybody know that?
I think they just have to do continuing ed.
No.
No, they have to retake their boards.
Yeah, I think once a decade. It's probably different every state. I know Brian Yates is studying to retake his boards right now. So I think once a decade in Washington, they have to do it. So they stay fairly up to date with things. And they're likely, most doctors are probably aware of the fact that some of this isn't settled science. And here's a quote from the Stahl's Essential Pharmacology. That's not too old, 8 years old, where he says, the new paradigm for understanding the relationship between genetics and psychiatry. So he's talking about, are there genetic markers that cause our mental health issues, right? He says the new paradigm for that conceptualizes genes not so much as direct causes of mental illness, but as direct causes of subtle molecular abnormalities that create risk for mental illness. Genes may thus act by biasing an individual's brain circuits toward inefficient information processing and possible breakdown into psychiatric symptoms under certain environmental circumstances. Now, sounds kind of technical, but I think you get what he's saying. We might have genetic markers or genetic abnormalities that aren't necessarily causing the problems, but combine that tendency or that contributor or that influence with certain environmental circumstances and it's going to cause a problem. Now, how does that come out in the everyday language of the guy in the street? I have an addictive personality. That's how it comes out in the vernacular of everyday speech. And they may actually have something in their makeup, in this body that is corrupted by sin. Like, we all got dysfunction in ourselves because we're sinners, right? They may have something in the way that their body functions that gives them that addictive personality. And they need to understand themselves and know, I can't give myself to that stuff because I can't say no after the first beer. I got to have the third and the fourth and the fifth and the sixth one. There's people like that, and they just need to know that. You know what? What else explains, perhaps, people who do say, I remember being attracted to the opposite sex from before I hit puberty? I mean, what else might explain that? Right? Could be environmental stuff, but it could be just this dysfunction, just the way sin has corrupted them, and there's something not quite right, and that's just a tendency that exists, and they just have to honor God with that tendency, right? I don't know. I'm just saying, we see so many things that just seem to be the natural bent of people towards sin, and that shouldn't surprise us. Some people have a natural bent toward one sin. Some have a natural bent toward another one. Some have a natural bent toward another one. And some of them are just more complicated than others. Some of them are addictions or depression. They used to call it melancholy. And maybe some are just have this natural bent toward same-sex attraction.
Okay, so I just wanted to clarify that. Because you said opposite sex in the beginning.
Oh, yeah. I meant same-sex. Sorry. Good clarification. Correct that on the tape, Seth. He's not even going to listen to it, but if he does, fix it. So I don't think psychiatry and medicine are so far off in this. I think you know, psychiatrists actually are medical doctors. Let's not forget that. And I think all of them are trying to stay current on the research with whatever spare time they have. And like I said earlier, the doctors are also subject to this social consciousness, and people are reading advertisements in magazines, and we're the only country in the world that allows the pharmaceutical companies to advertise the way we do. They're not really allowed to do that in other parts of the world. So it really hasn't helped us, I don't think, in terms of only using and prescribing medications that have been clearly tested as thoroughly as they should. So I used to have the numbers of the number of employees at the Federal Drug Administration that worked on the approval side and on the now that we've approved the drug, is it working and is it causing problems side. And it's like 1,000 to 1. It's just really bad. So once a drug gets approved, it's highly unlikely that it's going to get pulled off the market. And when it does, it usually takes a series of pretty bad things to happen. So, and that's why you see the stock price of pharmaceutical companies go through the roof when they get approval for a new drug. Their stock price just jumps because they know all that money we spent on research and development is going to start being turned into profit. So, also, and I said this earlier, there's nothing wrong with a doctor prescribing medication just to help people feel better. I think that's perfectly okay and legitimate. So, now how should we process the reality that some of the people who are coming to us for counseling are using medications or want to use them, etc. So what's it say in your notes? Rationale for use of drugs. if you've really determined as best you can or their doctor can that there's nothing that they've clearly identified as a physical cause for some of these symptoms, then but they still want to use the drugs, why might that be the case? And I'm going somewhere with this, so hang on. One, it could be that a person is unwilling to look at his life and look at his responses to life in light of biblical truth. He could be living by his feelings and not by principle. Doesn't see God in his trials. Or maybe his real goal in life is just to feel better. That's possible. Don't assume that. But it is possible. Doing the hard work of spiritual surgery when you're depressed or anxious or whatever, it can be hard work, and sometimes people just don't want to do that hard work, or they're convinced they don't need to. That could be possible. More likely is they've just experienced this for so long and they don't really know how. They don't know how to do that hard work, but praise God, they've come to talk to you or to one of us, right? And we're going to try to help them learn how to do that hard work of spiritual surgery and think about those problems in the way the scripture encourages us to think about them, whether their feelings change or not. And sometimes that's what we need to convince them of, that changing their feelings isn't the ultimate goal. So it's okay to have sorrow sometimes. Again, our culture doesn't like sadness, so we're there to patiently, compassionately guide them. It doesn't really matter if they're taking the meds, if they're willing to talk about their heart issue. So also, it's highly likely they've been told they have a chemical imbalance, or they've been told this medication will help. Okay, don't contradict it. Don't pretend that you know more, because you don't know either, right? We're bashing on one theory and saying my theory is better. Well, not really. Our theory is just a theory too, right? The point is that it's uncertain, and the one thing I am certain of is to be categorically certain is uncertain, right? We just shouldn't be categorical. We shouldn't be absolute, like we know this doesn't help or this is wrong, because that's not true. You should not be judgmental that a guy has believed their doctor. That's, 99.9 times out of 1,000, out of 100, that didn't make sense. Almost every time we all should believe our doctors, okay? So don't be judgmental that they believe their doctors. And don't be openly critical of his medical professional. So that's just not very helpful. Last, and I've experienced this in person, some people look at those medications as God's gift to them or God's grace to them, or as a way or part of the way to pursue solutions and help to the problems of their life. And that's okay, because I look at some medications as part of God's gift for me to pursue help when I need it. Like when I go home after standing on my feet all day, and I'm totally cool with that. Now I get it. Pain meds are a little bit different than things that alter your brain chemicals. So it's not a total parallel there, but it's really, even though we might think it's not necessary, it's not sinful either. And we need to definitely stop short of ever telling someone it's sinful to take a medication. Okay? You need to definitely stop short of ever saying that. It's not sinful to take a medication. So it's sinful to not be willing to work on your heart issues. It's sinful to not look at life the way God looks at it, but that may have nothing to do with their motivation or the action of taking a medication. So be very, very careful there. Some other questions just related to this issue that I think are helpful to consider briefly. What if in the future they are able to prove that this is real and true and it's fact? It's not just a theory, it's a fact. When they do that, they're not going to talk about the theory of chemical imbalance anymore. They're going to give it a medical diagnosis and they're going to help people treat it. So it won't be a theory. That's what will happen, and that'll be great if they actually figure it out and they know that they're fixing a problem, as opposed to right now where they haven't figured it out and they're not really sure if they're fixing a problem, right? Those two things are very different. Another question, wouldn't it be good? Can't it be good to use meds to control bizarre behavior or calm a person down so you can counsel them? Yeah, maybe. Could be. In some situations, probably. You want to protect people, right? I mean, if people are in really extreme cases, I mean, definitely if someone's suicidal and they've got a plan and you take them to Sacred Heart, they're probably going to give them some meds. And you know what? I'm good with that. Is anybody objecting? Give them some meds. Calm them down. That's totally fine. I don't think that's wrong. It might not be a long-term solution, but it could be a short-term solution. And I have dealt with people like that where I've said the same thing. I've said it point blank to them. I think it would be really good if you talk to your doctor. You don't seem to be emotionally stable enough to really talk about this issue. Let's see if we can get you emotionally stable enough to talk about the issues of your heart. I've said that to people that I've counseled, and I'm okay with that. I don't feel bad about it at all. I've also dealt with people who are on such high doses of the medication that I don't know who I'm talking to. And I don't usually meet with them. I just say, man, I don't think we can keep meeting. I think you really need to get stable, let your doctor figure out what a good level for you is, because they're loopy. They're on so much that they're loopy. And so that I don't think is good. Some of the questions that I will pose to these folks who have kind of just embraced the social consciousness and never really thought about it. And you got to be really careful here, because if you ask these questions the wrong way, you're going to come across as being judgmental or accusatory. But if you've got the right kind of relationship with them, asking them what tests were run to identify that you have a physical problem, because there aren't really tests. My doctor just talked to me. I told him how I felt, and he said, I might have a chemical imbalance, and this might help. So I just to let him realize, yeah, I guess there weren't any real tests. And then how was it proven that you have some physical condition, an imbalance that's causing those things? And of course, there isn't any proof. How can it be proven that the medication corrects that problem? Right, so you can ask those questions if you don't have to, but if you're trying to get someone past that point where they're saying no, the meds are what's going to help me, and to the point where no, I need to address the issues of my heart, then I think those questions can be helpful. The goal is to steer people to see that the social consciousness isn't necessarily medical science. So let's pursue God's solutions. The goal is really to move them toward a desire and a willingness to pursue God's solutions. And sometimes the biggest objection people have is they help me feel better. And in which I go, well, nothing wrong with that necessarily. But like I said, we'd be great if we had a session on a theology of emotions, but emotions, feelings are usually the product of our thinking. So they got a little diagram there. It's not the best diagram in the world, but it kind of is. You got circumstances and problems in life, and you have a certain way you think about those circumstances and problems. You think about them, you evaluate them, and that's going to cause feelings all in themselves, and it's also going to cause you to make certain choices and have certain behaviors, which may or may not cause more feelings. Those feelings are just the symptoms, right? The feelings that we're having, the emotions that we're having, may just be a product of our thinking and our behavior. They're not actually the problem. So the feelings are the caboose in the train of life. Excuse me. And so kind of like that spiral, this little step diagram, also not the greatest, but it's kind of the same. That's meant to picture that same thing I pictured with the spiral before, where you have this cycle of problems and unbiblical responses that produce bad feelings that cause more problems. And that's the idea. And some people just need to see that they should be pursuing God. So here's some conclusions. I would say broadly, medication is not needed in biblical counseling. You let their doctor decide what medications are needed and why. But in terms of just counseling, they're not needed. And I'm assuming when I say that we're dealing with real spiritual issues. So for some, like we said, it may hinder their motivation to seek heart-level solutions, right? If they feel better, why deal with the heart issues? It may. Don't assume that it would, but it may. But ultimately, we're dealing with spiritual issues, not physical issues. So just stay on task. Second, medications can be a temporary means to calm people's emotional swings so they can think and evaluate their hearts. And think and evaluate their hearts without the added pressure of those emotional swings. So I think of it kind of like a cortisone shot for an athlete. So, you know, an athlete might get a cortisone shot, get out there on the field. This is the playoffs, right? We got one more game. We just need you today. So we're going to give you that cortisone shot, send you out there, and you're going to do your thing. And it's not a permanent solution, but it gives some temporary relief so that you can function the way you need to function in order to come up with a lasting solution. So I think it's okay on a temporary basis. I don't encourage it. I don't talk about it. Don't care one way or another, but I don't think it's wrong, and that's why I have that point in there. But last, when there isn't any proven organic cause for the behavior or the emotions, use the Bible. Have confidence in the sufficiency of God's Word and prayerful dependence on the Holy Spirit to transform them. And that's really what you should be focused on anyway. So, so there's some principles I have in here. I don't know if I need to go through these because I think I included it all. The counseling principles. Isn't that pretty detailed in your notes? What comes after the counseling principles? Spend a lot of time learning about the problems in their life, etc. If they want to talk about the meds and how they've helped, go ahead and learn that. But you're trying to counsel them on the spiritual issues. Don't be critical of them if they're taking medications. Teach them biblical principles to apply to every problem of life, including helping them understand where their bad feelings come from, because ultimately I don't think their bad feelings have to do with their chemicals. Their bad feelings have to do with other things. So help them understand that. Your goal is not to get them off medication. Don't encourage them to stop taking medication. I never bring it up. I really don't care. So if they don't bring it up, I never bring it up. It's not of any concern to me unless they're loopy. And I just have to say, I can't meet with you. That's a different issue. But I never bring it up, and I don't think any of us ever should. There's no reason to. And so I have here, and I think it's in the notes, do not ever, 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 ever tell someone to stop taking their medications. Always, always, always refer them back to their doctor on those issues. That if there's one thing that's most important, because you're not a doctor, and you have probably a legal responsibility, perhaps in your church, like here with a church and liabilities, etc., you don't tell people to come off their meds. Always send them back to the doctor. Our goal is to help them become more Christ-like through the problems of life. Our goal isn't even to help them feel better. I like it when people feel better, and most people that are following Christ do find joy, and that's great. But our goal is to help them be more like Christ and to see Him and to walk with Him in the midst of their problems, and that's going to happen regardless of whether they're taking pills to feel one way or another. So, and the Bible's promised great victory, and I just keep pointing people to that over and over and over. I am thinking, you know, it'd be great. That says your goal is to teach them how to deal with the problems of life biblically so that medication would be unnecessary if there isn't a real medical reason for it. And that would be great. Some people just don't get there, and that's okay. I don't, again, that's not my goal. I've had it where people have come in and they're on meds and we work through their issues and they stop taking meds. I've had that happen and they've done really well. I've had others, they just keep taking them and I'm okay with that too. That's not really my goal. But they've changed. They've changed the way they think and they're changing the way they're responding to life and they're thinking about their life biblically. The med is just kind of this little thing over here. It's not a big issue. So one question, the last question here. So I've been counseling this person for a really long time and I can't really find any significant spiritual problems in his life. But they're still depressed or they're still anxious. And I've talked about everything. I've tried to gather all the data I can and we can't figure out. So I guess he just must need the medication to feel better. I don't really have an answer for that one other than to say, our goal isn't to help them feel better. I'm just going to keep saying it, right? So if they're depressed, it might actually be okay. And anxiety, well, it might depend on how they're responding to their anxiety, right? But that's not, how they feel isn't really our goal. So if they're thinking right about Christ, thinking right about their life and responding to Him in a worshipful way, I'm okay with that. Even if they still feel sorrow and sadness, so, or whatever else they're feeling. If they're already on the meds, again, you're not going to tell them anything. Send them back to their doctor. That's the whole last section. I do say, though, here, only discuss discontinuing meds when you're convinced that they're really thinking biblically, right? So if they say, I want to come off the thing, well, there are times when I've said, you really think you're ready for the emotional swings of life again, if that's what happens when you come off them. Are you ready to really put this thinking into practice when you might be a little more emotional? I'm not sure that'll happen, but it might. Maybe you've solved it. You think you're ready for that. Well, I want to try it. Well, then go talk to your doctor. If you want to come off the meds, that's fine. I think you're ready. Make sure. And I probably have as many people that come in that have medication guilt. I'm on these meds, but I'm a Christian. I shouldn't have to take these pills. And I say some of this stuff to them. Well, what does that matter? I take pills. I don't take those pills, but I like to feel okay. So I just talk them through these issues. It's okay. It's not right or wrong if you're on them. If you don't want to be on them, if you want to handle your emotions in a different way, God's way, that's great. I'll help you do that. So they may actually have bad motives for coming off meds, right? Someone could actually have bad motives for coming off meds. I might talk to them about that too. So whenever people that I've been counseling have come off their medications, I keep in close touch with them. So no less than weekly meetings for a good month while that kind of levels out. It's because I want to know if they're continuing to have the ability to think right, respond right to life and to their emotions. So I keep in close touch with them if they're doing that. So far that's always been a helpful and healthy thing. So any questions on that?
Did someone who's kind of in that place where they're like, okay, well, I'm maybe feeling guilty about taking the medication, and do you ever see that as, okay, well, whatever's not of faith is sin? Do you ever have a connection? Have you ever seen someone basically taking or not taking medication and not doing such out of faith and therefore being in sin?
You know, honestly, that's what guilt is, right? It's you don't have a clear conscience. I shouldn't have to take these. I don't think God wants me to take these. if they're saying stuff like that. It is kind of a conscience issue. I've never really addressed it that way, though. I'll ask them, why do you think that, and try to correct their thinking. But I think my default mode of never, ever, ever, ever telling someone to come off their meds has prevented me from saying something like, well, if you feel guilty about it, you should stop. I'm not going to do that. So, man, that's a good question. I got to be honest. I haven't really put it in that category. So if I did, I would still send them back to their doctor. I'm hands off on that issue for all the obvious reasons. That's a good question. All right, let's take a short break. I'll get this video set up, and then we'll fire up.
Thank you for listening to this audio from Faith Bible Church. Feel free to share. We only ask that you do not alter the content in any way and that you do not charge for it. Visit us online at fbchurch.org for more sermons, articles, and other resources, as well as information about our ministries.